Hello.
And welcome to Dragons Made Me Do It, one of potentially many podcasts about Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Pern series, but the only one by us.
I'm Shay.
And I'm Tequila Mockingbird. And today we are going back to the beginning and reading Weir Search, which is the novella that McCaffrey wrote in 1967, published in Analog Magazine, that eventually became Dragonflight.
Yeah.
You might say you've already read Dragonflight. Yeah.
Yes, it is slightly, but in some cases, significantly different, as we will discuss. This is also going to be our recap of the podcast as a whole. Technically, there is one more Pern story that we are not reading, namely Dragon Rider, but that's because it makes more sense to go right back to the beginning.
Obviously, they are both slightly different from when they were eventually turned into Dragonflight, but I think I'm more interested in the little screenshot of McCaffrey stepping into Pern for the very first time.
Agreed. As a warning, in this episode, we will be discussing suicide in addition to our usual general content warnings. So Weir Search covers the first section of Dragonflight. It begins, as Dragonflight does, with a prologue that differs from the prologue in Dragonflight in some small but significant ways. It begins with the same prologue that's in Dragonflight with some small but striking differences, in particular where Dragonflight refers to the Pernese settlers' forgotten Terran forebears. The Weir Search prologue refers to their forgotten Yankee forebears.
I love that energy.
Which is wild and extra funny because she makes them Alaskans in Dragon's Dawn. Anne.
Yeah, I think that distinction reflects, to me at least, more of a generic sci-fi of the period feeling.
Yes.
Calling something Terran is, to me, this very, oh yeah, we're that mid-century sci-fi baby vibe.
Oh wait, I was going to say the opposite, actually. I feel like the Forgotten Yankee Forebears feels much more... Oh, this was published in a mid-century American science fiction magazine, whereas Terran feels a little more open-ended to me.
I don't know. The reason to swap, right, is to try and make it less specific or less American.
Yeah.
Or to try and make it sound more formal. I think that's what it is for me, is that it sounds more like this is official sci-fi talk, as opposed to Yankee, which is just like, what are you doing?
Mm.
She does reference Irish know-how in Dragon's Dawn.
Truly, it's like many of our ancestors were Alaskans, so we've got that Alaskan pioneer spirit in our blood because being Alaskan is genetic.
I don't think I know anyone from Alaska, but I suspect they would not prefer to be referred to as a Yankee.
Well, I guess it depends on who's doing the referring, right? But somehow yeah. I am pretty sure that she means Yankee in the sense of someone from the Northeast or New England specifically, rather than the sense of an American.
Yeah.
So that's a little funny. But I do just want to double down on, she's been telling us literally since the second paragraph of the first publication of any Pern content that this is science fiction. And I do think that the fact that there are dragons is probably why she felt she had to do that.
It does feel like it's very intentional. Staking a place for itself in a science fiction magazine. And I think that, as we discussed in our very first episode, the rather roughly hewn faux medieval caricature cultural stuff going on is maybe why she felt like she had to signpost it that much. It's not just the dragons, but it's the dragons and the serving wenches and the fires and the hangings and the rushes on the floor, and all of that is very much speaking that language of fantasy.
Yeah,
I am continuing to be on the hill where I have died, especially since you made me read the stupid ghost dragon short story. That these are a fantasy series. Deal with it.
Part of what's going on, too, as we talked about in our recap episode, is that this is the period when fantasy is becoming a distinct marketing category from science fiction, and when the kind of planetary romance that Pern is starting to be on its way out more and more.
Mm.
So she's also staking her continued place in science fiction and saying, like, no, I'm still writing a planetary romance story. I'm still doing Sword and Planet. I'm not doing the Sword and Sorcery revival that's happening at the same time. I'm not doing the early consolidation of a fantasy canon in the late 60s. I'm still doing this other thing.
And she kept doing it for 35 years, so it worked for her.
She sure did. Although also, notably, it gets a lot less planetary romance as it goes on.
It's true.
And it gets a lot more. Now we're just doing normal sci-fi. There's spaceships. There's flying cars. there's blowing up rocket engines on far-off planets.
Terrible economic policy.
Yeah.
And I think rereading it, I had some fun nostalgia. Not that I ever read the short story as a kid, but for the parts of Dragonflight that I loved because I was a hashtag Lessa girl. And so all of that that I loved so much was already here in WeirSearch. What really stuck in my head was this scene of Lessa in the bath, changing and washing up and getting ready and then running out onto the hatching ground. I feel like that, and of course, queens can fly, that's why they have wings, are the two moments from Dragonflight that have always stuck with me the hardest.
Interesting. What I was really struck by in reading WeirSearch is the extent to which, while there are still some F'lar sections, the emphasis is really on Lessa. Like, this is a story about Lessa.
And Flar's there.
And also, F'lar is there, but this is a story about Lessa. And to some extent, that's still true of Dragonflight, but I feel like the balance in Dragonflight is much more 50-50 between them.
Maybe 60-40.
Maybe 60-40. And crucially, she's added more F'lar in Dragonflight. So WeirSearch is missing two particular F'lar things. One, his conversation with Fax when they get to Ruatha, where Fax is like, haha, here's Ruatha that you had such high hopes for. And F'lar's like, fuck, was that obvious? That's not in this. We just get a brief two-sentence summary of it when F'lar is talking to Fëanor later. And second, the scene when they're at Benden, while Lessa is bathing and getting changed, F'lar and Fëanor in Dragonflight have a conversation where F'lar is like, yeah, everything's fine. And Fëanor's like, I know you're pretending everything's fine, but I have to tell you that Tabor and Kanet and Urgul brought other candidates, and they might also be good. And F'lar's like, no, it's fine. I have the one. That's also not in WeirSearch, so that was added for Dragonflight. Whereas I think the only Lessa thing that was added in Dragonflight is the scene where Lessa and Jemma interact.
As Jeb is giving birth and then dying. Yeah.
The balance of added material is skewed towards F'lar, which tells you that the balance of original material was a little more Lessa.
Yeah. And I feel like both from Dragonflight, but also for the whole book series, Lessa is the specialist girl on Pern.
Yeah.
That never changes. She continues to be the specialist girl, even when she's an older character, even in comparison to other very special girls in other books. There's some magic in Lessa, and it's fascinating and baffling that McCaffrey doesn't seem to want to let any other female character be as unapologetically themselves and weird and powerful and aggressive as Lessa, because I really feel like she did something really cool there, even though Lessa is an awful person.
Yeah.
And Meneli comes close, I think. Meneli and Moretta also get to be very special, but.
Yeah, Meneli is good Lessa,
Right.
but Meneli also stops being a main character after Dragonsinger.
And even though Lessa's never the protagonist again, she punches above her weight, I think, even in later books in the Ninth Pass. She still gets point of view scenes. She still gets things to do.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there are any other female characters who get that much recurring page time, and I don't think there are. Meneli has
Scenes.
her bits and pieces in Dragon Drums, and I think that's it. In Dolphins, we maybe have like two scenes that are focalized through her, and that's it, and none in Skies of Pern.
Yeah.
So there are other female protagonists, but no other enduring female protagonists. There are people who are present for one book. There are people who are at the center of things for one book, but never get a POV scene, Aramina, but not any other female characters who get to keep coming back and who we get to keep seeing the world through.
Yeah. And we've talked before about the fact that it's possible some of that was a purely pragmatic publishing decision. She definitely tilts the lens a lot more towards male characters as the series continues.
Yeah, even in All the Weirs of Pern, Jaxum and F'lar collaborate to sideline Lessa and make sure that she doesn't get to help with the Red Star mission.
So it's possible that that reflected a shift in McCaffrey's interests or priorities, and it's possible that was just what she thought was going to sell. I don't think it is ever the only thing that is relevant in a creative work, but I do think knowing things about the author at the time that they wrote it is interesting. And so I pose the question about whether Lessa is the creation of McCaffrey's divorce, this entirely intransigent, uncooperative woman who gets to continue to be so, is in some way an expression of that. And she kind of wrote it out of her. She's done. She's good. She's got a farm in Ireland. Life's great. But maybe that's too much armchair psychology.
As we observed with Dragon Quest, it seems striking that McCaffrey published Dragonflight and then within 3 years was divorced and had moved to Ireland to write her next book. Whether Dragonflight was the instigator or not, it certainly happened at a turning point in her personal life.
And the fake good version of Perrin that only lives in my head definitely has a lot to do with how Lessa is treated in this book series and by the narrative around her. I think she should be allowed to do as many murders as she wants.
Who else do you think Lessa should murder?
It's not really that there are specific people, although numerous old timers, I'm definitely like, you know, that would be fine by me. Yeah, the problem is all of the villains are kind of anemic. Like, I guess she could murder Thella if she wants to.
She could murder Toric. I think that would be
Yeah,
justified.
there we go. That's the right answer. Yes, Lessa should be allowed to murder Toric. Alas, never to be. That's the fanfic to write.
The only other person I feel like Lessa would actively want to murder, unfortunately, is Mirren, but I don't think he deserves it. He's horrible, but not murderable.
Yeah.
Whereas Toric is like less horrible, but also more murderable, I think.
The different axis, hard, murderable.
Among other broad sets of changes and retcons that jumped out at us here, one is the portrayal of violence between WeerSearch and, by extension, Dragonflight and the rest of the series. So, looking back on it, some of the stuff that happens here is wild. I mean, the impression scene.
It's pretty brutal. I feel like in other impression scenes, what we get is that the dragons accidentally harm humans because they're trying to get to the right human and this other human is in the way. But Ramoth actively goes away from Lessa, mauls or murders two random teenage girls. And then Lessa has to go up to her and be like, hey, I'm over here, and turn Ramoth's face toward her. So it's very much not Ramoth is trying to find the right person. It's Ramoth is murdering whoever comes close to her until she finds the right person. And while on one hand that's very Ramoth, on the other hand, that's just not, I think, the vibe that we get, even when other hatchings involve violence.
The male candidates I feel like are a little bit more.
Aligned with what we see elsewhere, yeah. Because the dragon accidentally walks over a male candidate, and then another dragon comes up and is like, oh no. And he's like, no, it's just a scratch. It's okay.
But there's also the candidate who gets thrown against the wall, which is a level of violence that we don't see from the Dragonettes later. It's more they're clumsy, they trip over themselves, they trip over other people. They're not throwing people around.
And I think that also lines up with what we see about violence in human societies. You pointed out that the warder is carrying a whip when he's talking to the drudges. And to be fair, we don't spend a lot of time with drudges, but we don't see that in either of the two scenes where our protagonists are pretending to be drudges, either in Norilka or Pymer in Dragon Drums.
And really, if it were going to happen anywhere, surely it would be happening at N'Bol in Dragon Drums. And it doesn't seem to be. Not that there isn't still corporal punishment, because there is. People are getting hit, but they're not getting whipped.
And people are getting treated pretty brutally in Dragon's Eye, but in that, it's specifically supposed to be horrific and shocking and bad, where this is treated very much as if it's normal.
We know from Lessa's perspective that the current warder is particularly ineffective, but there's no indication that the fact that he has a whip is remarkable. Even from Falar's perspective, it doesn't seem like anything that's happening at Ruatha is totally beyond the norm of how servants could be treated in a context where the servants have performed their work inadequately, as Vax takes to be the case here.
And we spoke a little bit in, I believe, our Master Harper episode, questioning whether this distinction between the Pernes worlds that we see in Dragonflight, at least with the human society, is supposed to be this is Pern under Fax versus this is Pern in a more normal context, right? Is this supposed to genuinely be different? Or does that reflect a shift in McCaffrey's intentions and writing style as she developed and as the series developed? I think the fact that the dragon energy also changes is maybe an argument that it's McCaffrey retconning rather than an intentional choice to place Wrathahold under Fax's rule as distinct from the rest of Pernes society. Because I think we also have the knife fights. In the original trilogy, there's a knife fight per book. We have Fax and Falar in Dragonflight. We have
Falar and Taron in Dragon Quest.
But also the Green Rider who stabs Fëanor.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so there's two. Well, it's not really a knife fight. I would say Fëanor gets stabbed, but Fëanor has not also drawn a knife.
Okay, fair. Knife violence.
The only knife fight in Dragon Quest is the Fëlar-Tyrann duel at Telgar. Rip to Telgar Hold, as
It's just a
always.
violent place, clearly. Sala's legacy lives on in just shooting first and asking questions later. And then Fëlar and T'Col in The White Dragon. And we also have the suggestion of a knife fight in Dragonsinger, but if I recall correctly, they don't actually draw the knives, it's just a fist fight.
Yeah, correct. Mentally has her hand on her dagger, which seemed to me was less like, I'm prepared to draw my knife on you, Pona, and more,
Hey, I have one.
I am issuing a formal challenge now.
Yeah, but then never really again in the series.
Yeah, except the full-on incident in Master Harper, but that also is back in this same period.
So, yeah, does this imply that there was, during the long interval, a fad for knife fighting? And then once they had thread to worry about, they were all just like, actually, that's very stupid. We're not going to do that anymore. Or does it imply that McCaffrey felt like it wasn't necessary or engaging to have that as a world-building element?
You know what? Something that we do know from later books is that punishments are harsher during a pass than they are during an interval, in that during a pass, you can be staked out to be eaten alive by Thread,
Yeah.
and during an interval, you get exiled.
So what?
So it's possible that from McCaffrey's perspective, that's a deterrent, and people don't get in duels anymore because it risks you getting exiled for murder if the circumstances around the duel are not legally up to standard.
So basically, when there's no Thread, chaos reigns. But as soon as the threat of Thread is available, people buckle it up.
Yeah,
I don't know about that.
I don't think that is realistic, but that's all I've got explanation-wise. But in any case, there's obviously been a shift in the way that the series is thinking about violence. And I think part of that is maybe because as the series goes on, and even as Dragonflight goes on, she gets a lot more interested in the overarching social structure and a lot less interested in specific interpersonal political dramas.
Yeah.
Even though obviously the interpersonal stuff is still a factor as the series goes on.
But why does nobody fight Toric with a knife? Is the question that I come out of this with. If anybody should be fought with a knife, surely it is Toric.
Well, he's on the verge of drawing his knife on Fëlar later, right? So it's not totally beyond the realm of possibility. Knife fights could still happen. They just don't, coincidentally.
What I'm realizing now that we've laid it out, though, is that the through line here is Fëlar and his dad, with
Yeah.
Mennally as perhaps an outlier. But again, there's no actual knife fight in Dragonsinger. So maybe it's just that Fëlan loved to fight people with knives and pass that on to his oldest son, and they're just violent freaks.
So aside from the Fëanor thing, there is one other initiated knife combat, which is when Galanar attempts to stab Jaxum in All the Weirs of Pern. But
That
that,
feels more like a political assassination, though.
yeah, and it's not a duel.
Right.
It's that he sneaks up on Jaxum's tent in the night and wakes him up trying to stab him.
Very different.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think I'm just going to decide that Fëlan and his sons are a little bit wild with the knives.
That seems reasonable given the evidence.
And that they're also just wild in other ways. This is not a healthy family dynamic.
True.
I also loved the line here where Fëanor is like, wow, this is my first piece of evidence that Fëlar feels emotions. And I'm like, you guys are in your 30s. What the fuck?
Well, Lessa has the same thing, but she's only known him for a couple hours, so it's more forgivable.
Right. Les has only known him for a couple of hours. That's a very standard romance trope. Oh, wow. He's actually vulnerable and has feelings, but he's just tough on the outside. Fëanor has been his little brother their whole life. That's not okay.
Fëlar.
You saw him impress. He wasn't happy when he impressed Fëanor.
One other thing that jumped out at me here that is also in Dragonflight, but that I had forgotten, is that in Fëlar's first POV section, as they're arriving at High Reaches and he's looking out in disgust at all of the greenery, we get this. When this search was over and the impression made, there would have to be a solemn, punitive council held at the Weir. And by the golden shell of the queen, he, Fëlar, meant to be its moderator. He would replace lethargy with industry. He would scour the green and dangerous scum from the heights of Pern, the grass blades from its stoneworks. No verdant skirt would be condoned in any farmhold. And the tithings, which had been so miserly, so grudgingly presented, would, under pain of fire stoning, flow with decent generosity into the dragon weir. So that's really interesting because in the next section, Dragon Rider, they do have a conversation about this. And using Firestone to motivate people is suggested not by Falar, and everyone is horrified by this. Falar is opposed to it. So it's kind of wild that here Falar is like, yeah, we need to instill fear in the masses in order to make them respect the Weir again.
Just murder people by setting fire to them with our dragon.
Yeah, well, also, surely it's not actually, I'm going to burn people with this, but either you give us your produce or we burn your fields and you starve, I feel like is the takeaway here. Because the holds are made of stone and metal. They can just go inside and they will be safe from dragon riders.
Well, I mean, yes. And you don't want to get me started on siege tactics.
It would be difficult, I think, for 140 dragon riders to besiege every hold on the planet.
More pertinent, perhaps, is the way that in every other context, dragon riders are framed very intentionally, it seems, as having this sacred duty to protect all of Pern.
Yeah.
In Dragon's Eye, they explicitly are like, oh, we're allowed to rescue refugees who are being treated badly and defend them from their own Lord Holder because we have this implicit duty to ensure the safety of every single person on Pern from Thread, and that carries over to from mistreatment as well.
Yeah, Falar says as much here, right? So first we get the dragon riders, they serve as binding legal witnesses to oaths, but also that at the end, when Falar finally catches Lessa, he's like, you know, if you just told me, I would have been ready to fight Fax myself. And his perspective says that's not entirely true, but then he follows it up with, a dragon rider can champion anyone whose cause is just, provided they present their case to him. And there's nothing that indicates that that's not true, and I think a lot to indicate over the course of the series that that probably is true, that dragon riders can serve as neutral advocates because they are not bound to any hold.
And I do feel like it makes sense for Pernie's culture for them to build those fail-safes in, because as we've discussed, when you have a portion of your population that has a giant fucking dragon, you as a society really have to figure out, okay, why are these people not just going to become tyrannous overlords who can murder anyone at will?
Yeah.
You cannot overpower someone with a dragon very easily. And it seems like there's a lot of checks and balances in Pernia's society, some of that being the tithing and the fact that dragon riders don't really have an independent income stream, some of that being this cultural inculcation of a dragon rider as a champion of the common man to prevent that from ever happening. So the fact that Falar is just casually like, oh, fuck these peasants, is something.
Yeah, and while I hadn't remembered this specific moment, the tone of Falar in this first section of Dragonflight, and so in Weir Search, is really what defines Falar for me as a character. This extremely, I'm going to make the Weir great again, fascistic vibe that he has at the beginning of the series.
Interesting. Here's my question. Is Falar Lessa's romantic interest in this novella?
No, absolutely not.
Does McCaffrey know that they are going to fall in love?
That's a different question. I don't know the answer.
Right? Because I feel like you get basically the same interactions, including the not stated but very clear implication that Lessa is concerned he's going to sexually assault her.
Yeah, 100%.
Moments where she's realizing she can't get down without a dragon, where she's like, I don't want to talk to him in a room with a bed. It's not subtle, even if it's not spelled out in so many words.
Yeah.
And I see a little bit of resonance there too with the fact that in Dragonflight, the Lady Tella is presented as a companion that Fax provides Falar, but I very much assumed reading that it was a social companion. She's sitting with him at dinner, where Weir Search makes it very clear that he is allowed and expected to have sex with Lady Tella.
Yeah, and is refusing to do so.
Yeah, which made clear why the fact that she was pregnant already was an insult, which I remember in Dragonflight being like, so why do you care if she's pregnant? Like, what does that have to do with anything? So just that extra layer of overt sexual commodification of women that we see in Weir Search that seems to have faded by even just Dragonflight.
Yeah.
And there is the fact that Falar is like, oh, you should be the Weir woman. But we don't get anything about mating flight in this novella.
Yeah.
So it's entirely possible that McCaffrey has not yet decided that the Weir woman is the person who fucks the Weir leader. And the fact that Falar is super confidently, I'm going to be the one to be in charge by the time we have that conference, sort of suggests that she hasn't. Because there is no way that Remoth could come to sexual maturity and there could be a mating flight before he's imagining that conference, right?
Yeah.
So if he's thinking, I'm going to be the one to be the moderator, that sort of suggests that being the moderator or being the Weir leader is not linked to the sexual interaction with the Queen Rider yet in the world building.
Yeah, and it must have happened soon because Dragon Rider...
That's what it is.
...does have...
That's kind of what happens in Dragon
the
Rider.
...the mating flight. Yeah. So it's possible that she already was sort of working it out. But yeah, she clearly cannot have had all of the details already in mind about how weird leadership works.
Because, again, as someone who has read a lot of romance novels, I do think there's an implicit positioning where Falar is clearly the male character with the most screen time and who has the on-page interactions with Lessa, where if you are reading this in the context of an expectation for a heterosexual romance subplot to develop, he is the obvious person it's going to develop with.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you are reading it with that expectation.
Right. Especially if you're reading it in analog in 1967.
Right.
It's not like this is being published in a romance publication. It's being published in one of the hard science fiction publications. So I don't know if that framing would have been on the majority of readers' minds.
He could have just been the antagonistic mentor character.
Right.
I don't know enough about how the average analog reader would have interpreted this. As we mentioned in our episode on Dragonflight, the romance novel as a genre existed. It just wasn't really sexy yet, or it was becoming sexy at the same time. But Georgette Heyer novels existed, and it's definitely not out of keeping with the romance genre as it existed for there to be an antagonistic meeting between the male and the female character, the Pride and Prejudice model, as we discussed. So I don't think it's outlandish in any way for him to be both antagonistic and the future romantic lead.
Yeah.
But I also do feel like if I don't come into this being like, oh, and they're going to fall in love, I don't really know that that's the vibe.
Yeah, the age difference in particular, I feel like...
Feels more marked here, yeah.
Feels more marked here, yeah. Falar is clearly a 30-something who's got an established professional career, and Lessa is a 20-year-old who has been living for the last 10 years in hiding as a servant and has to be told, you can eat as much as you want. You're a woman, so of course you eat first. So again, not that that would foreclose the possibility, but it feels to me more like Falar is her mentor, and that there is a 1960s gendered dynamic to that, right? Lessa comes out of the bath all clean with her hair combed out, and Falar's like, oh, you're prettier than I expected, but in a way that does not to me necessarily feel like flirting and more just him being like, huh,
you were using psychic powers to make me think you were old and ugly. Wow.
And also a certain amount of like, you really are a woman, in a way that to me felt more like, oh, you could be a good werewoman. Because of course the werewoman has to be hot.
Yes, obviously. Pernice society collapses if the werewoman is not hot.
Yeah.
This is what was wrong in the long interval. Jorah was not hot enough.
In Dragonflight, do we get the specific comment about the fact that
she cleans up nice?
Even though she's really skinny, she's got big boobs?
Yeah, I think we do.
Okay.
I feel like I remember it.
Because I did not remember that, but it jumped out more in this.
Well, obviously. Your skinny female protagonist has to have disproportionately large boobs. Everyone knows this. She can't be skinny in a way that's actually unattractive.
I feel like in later books, she's described as not having especially prominent breasts.
Well, it says does not entirely reflect the gauntness. It doesn't necessarily.
True. She has, in relative terms, big boobs.
Yeah. I also feel like, and again, I think a lot of this is because we're inside Lessa's point of view. I don't think it really emphasizes how short she is in a way that almost all of the other material does.
Yeah.
Lessa could be any height here.
True. Yeah.
So maybe there's just some stuff that McCaffrey decided would be fun, because I feel like the point where we start getting more physical descriptions of her, they are more focused on how just tiny she is.
Yeah.
And maybe concomitantly, she's got a little less going on in the bust because McCaffrey's reconceptualized her as tiny and naturally just petite, where here it feels like she's maybe of average height, but underfed.
Yeah.
Though also, here's some just broader historical context. That is kind of what childhood malnutrition can do to you. Mm. And obviously she was well fed until she was 10. So I don't know if that would have the same effect.
Yeah, who knows?
Who can say?
So there are a bunch of more general changes and retcons. One of the perhaps funniest is she had no idea what was going on with the geography in Weir Surge.
Rotha is next to Tillich, and I love that.
Yeah, even already in Dragonflight, she's settled on a lot more things. But here we get a description of, first of all, Fax's hold is east of Ruatha, and Ruatha, it can get the wind coming off Tillic.
Aigen is far to the north.
Right, Aigen is in the far north. It's wild times over here in Weirsearch Pern. But it speaks to a broader ambiguity about the geography. I mean, it makes sense that it's not clear. The first map didn't show up until Dragon Quest in 1971, and it is very different from the later
It's
maps.
different.
It does have Ruatha sort of in the right quote-unquote place, but many other things about it are very weird. And the final map doesn't show up until the 1978 hardcover edition of The White Dragon. So it was a solid 10 years before we got the final quote-unquote version of Pern.
Where is Karun? We just don't know.
Yeah, it's Karun and Telgar. Telgar is
Yeah.
all over the place. In the 1971 map, Telgar is way down south, not on the coast, but near the coast, and Crom is kind of where Telgar is in the final map.
And I think they're supposed to be near each other, aren't they?
They are supposed to be not that far from each other, yeah.
Yeah.
And Nabol doesn't exist. Then by the mid-70s books, like by Dragonsong, again, Ruatha is sort of moving around a little bit, and Telgar is migrating more north as things go on. And then finally, in 1978, we get the one where, oh yeah, okay, Telgar's up in the north, Crom is not that far away, Ruatha is
Between Fort and Telgar.
further down, well, between Fjord and Crom and Nabol.
Right.
Yeah, she doesn't have a location for Nerot Hold on the earliest maps, but the Nerot Peninsula is labeled.
Yeah.
It seems, and this is something that's already true in Weirsearch, actually, it seems in the 1971 map that a lot of the labels are less about holds and more about regions. So they're a little vaguely positioned. And it does seem, this is something that we were talking about before we started. I mean, you were asking about the way she's using high reaches and talking about holds here.
Because it felt to me like the High Reaches was multiple things as opposed to a single place.
Yeah.
I was sort of wondering whether it was supposed to be the term that referred to all seven of Fax's conquered holds because they call them the High Holds, or whether that High Holds was just to distinguish Ruatha, Crom, High Reaches, and Nabol from the three minor holds, or what.
Yeah, to me, it definitely seems like she's meaning High Reaches as a region here, rather than thinking that there's a High Reaches hold, and that maybe when it came time to assemble things for Dragonflight, she was like, it's too much trouble. I don't have a full map yet. It'll still be High Reaches, but we're gonna pretend that it's one hold now. But even at the beginning of Dragonflight, there's still a certain amount of like, ah, you have the High Reaches, and that referring to all of Fax's domain.
Yeah.
But I think you could sort of reinterpret that as being like, oh, well, it's called the High Reaches because High Reaches is the.
The mountain range.
But also because High Reaches is his original quote unquote hold.
Right.
So it's kind of all under his domain in the same way that as the Ottoman Empire expanded, you could talk about the subregions in it, but the Ottoman Empire would cover all of it, even if it was territory that was just conquered a year ago.
I also noted we get a lot more of Ruath Hold or Hold Ruath, and that persists in Dragonflight a little bit. But
Yes.
by the time we get to Dragon Quest, it's pretty consistently Ruatha.
Yeah, and I think even in Dragonflight, I don't think we get Hold Ruath or Hold Ruatha. I think we just get
Ruath Hold, yeah.
Ruath Hold and Ruatha Hold. And then by Dragon Quest, yeah, it's always just Ruatha, I'm pretty sure.
And some of this obviously is just the editing that happens when you take a novella and turn it into the beginning of a novel.
Yeah.
And I think mostly those edits were for the better. I noticed one great little moment when Filar is talking about how brave Lessa is, where in Weirsearch it's just, oh, you have courage enough. And in Dragonflight, it's courage enough to fly with. And I liked that addition because I think it presages what's going to come in what I guess came out of Dragon Rider, the
Yeah.
short story, where her actually flying on Ramoth is a point of contention. But I really liked it.
Well, I think the addition of the scene with Gemma
Yeah.
also, I think, is really good, in part because we do get in Weirsearch the comment when Filar is like being pointed to her about Gemma, Lessa reacts, and Filar is like, oh, so she does actually regret Gemma's death. And it's nice in Dragonflight to have a moment of them actually interacting so that we get Lessa realizing that this woman is in not the same situation as her, but not a dissimilar situation to her, and that she has ill-used Gemma.
Is this Lessa's only moment of female solidarity?
It's definitely up there.
Can you think of another one?
No. Not in gendered terms, anyway. The only other one that comes to mind is in Dragonsong when Menelaus' fire lizards show up and Lessa sends everyone away, and Menelaus like having a breakdown, and Lessa's like, "It's okay. We just needed to know that they existed, and now we
Don't
do.
worry about it.
It's fine." And Menelaus like, "They're gonna send me away," and Lessa's like, "If you can impress nine fire lizards, you belong in the Weir." That's the one other moment that jumps out at me as Lessa actually having a
Positive interaction with another female character.
yes. That's not immediately followed by kidnapping her like Aramina.
I think she respects Minora's professionalism.
Yes, but it's very much, I think, a professional respect.
Yes, colleague.
And not a, like, I'm having a personal moment with you. It's not like that with Minora.
I am slightly your daughter-in-law and also your boss. Although there are some things that I think were lost in the editing, which I think are a shame. When Fëanor is thinking about how cool and macho and what a good knife fighter his older brother is, he does think the sentence, "Fëanor had tumbled every man in the Weir efficiently and easily."
So
And
true.
I don't know why that was taken out for the publication of Dragonflight. Tragic.
I think the only reading of this has to be that my Flower Ghoul story is canon.
Yeah, absolutely. The other change, which I'm not sure if it was good or bad, but is definitely marked, is instead of cloth men and leather men, we have the weavers as a craft. But that doesn't happen until after Dragonflight, right?
So in Weir Search and in the beginning of Dragonflight, when they visit Lightall, they're going to the Clothmen's Hall with capital C. And when they leave Lightall in Weir Search, they're going to the Leathermen's Hall, capital L. In Dragonflight, they're going to the lowercase leather-men's hall. So it does seem like she hadn't yet settled on the craft structure, but by the end of Dragonflight, she had.
Zurg.
Because we do get, like, Zurg the Master Weaver is there.
But is the Master Tanner there?
I don't think so, because I don't think we know who the Master Tanner is at any point, actually.
Yeah.
Maybe in the Dragon Lover's Guide, but.
Because I think we know that there is a Tanner's Craft Hall, but
Yes, because
not.
Tanner Ligand keeps coming back.
Exactly. But yeah, I think maybe Tanner Ligand is the first official introduction we get.
No, because there's a Weir Tanner in Dragonsong.
Okay.
But either way, not until Harper Hall trilogy, I don't think.
And that felt very much of a piece with all of the weird, deliberate neologisms that we see throughout Pernice culture, runner beast, and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Cloth man. And eventually she apparently was like, that's too silly or that doesn't work, and just went with Weaver.
Yeah.
In her defense, Leatherman, the multi-tool brand, was not founded till 1983. So maybe they got it from her as opposed to the other way around.
So there are two other specific things in terms of editorial choices that we wanted to flag. One is, again, the question of dragon genders. Larth, Lightall's dragon, first of all, is described as a green here. We've talked about that before. Second of all, is referred to as he. Much though I would love to believe that Larth is a he-him lesbian dragon, it seems a little bit unlikely that she had that in mind.
Alas.
And Tumblr user Threadfall did point out after our first episode, question mark.
I think, or a second, maybe.
Yeah, one of our early episodes that this persists in Dragonflight, in fact. But by the end of Dragonflight, we do get references to greens being female.
And then by what, Dragon Quest? Larth is a brown.
By Dragon Quest, Larth is a brown.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it seems like also she had not fully worked out the dynamics of dragons at this point, and even by the end of Dragonflight, maybe was still.
Noodling.
Yeah.
And that, I think, circles back around to I don't think that she knew that it was a you have to have sex situation
Yeah.
that made the Weir Leader the Weir Leader. All of the mating stuff seems probably still not fully realized in this one, at least.
Yeah. The other big change that jumped out at us here, big in relative terms, it's a 30-page novella, is about the death of the Watchwer.
As they are about to leave, Lessa's a little reluctant. She pets the watchwear, and Flar's like, yeah, let's go. He took her hand again to help her to her feet and lead her back to Minimen. As they turned, he glimpsed the watchwear launching itself at a dead run after Lessa. The chain, however, held fast. The beast's neck broke with a sickeningly audible snap. Lessa was on her knees in an instant, cradling the repulsive head in her arms. Why, you foolish thing? Why? She asked in a stunned whisper as the light in the beast's green-gold eyes dimmed and died out. Menementh informed Fëanor that the creature had lived this long only to preserve the Ruathan line. At Lessa's imminent departure, it had welcomed death. And then she takes off the collar, pats it once, and walks to Menementh without a single backward glance, and leaves Ruatha.
So here's how it goes in Dragonflight, as you may remember. He took her hand again to help her to her feet and lead her back to Nementhe. In one split second, he was knocked off his feet, sprawling across the stones and trying to roll to his feet again to face his adversary. The force of the initial blow, however, had dazed him, and he lay sprawled on his back, startled to see the watchword, its scaly body launched, straight at him. Simultaneously, he heard Lessa's startled exclamation and Nementhe's roar. The bronze's great head was swinging around to knock the watchword aside, away from the dragon man. But just as the watchword's body was fully extended in its leap, Lessa cried out, "Don't kill! Don't kill!" The watchword, its snarl turning into an anguished cry of alarm, executed an incredible maneuver in midair, turning aside from its trajectory. As it fell to the stone yard at his feet, Flar heard the dull crack as the force of its landing broke its back. Before he could get to his feet, Lessa was cradling the hideous head in her arms, her face stricken. Nementhe lowered his head to tap the dying watcher's body gently. He informed Falar that the beast had guessed Lessa was leaving Ruatha, something one of her blood should not do. In its senile confusion, it could only assume Lessa was in danger. When it heard Lessa's frantic command, it had corrected its error at the expense of its life. "It was truly only defending me," Lessa added, her voice breaking. She cleared her throat. "It was the only one I could trust, my only friend." Falar awkwardly patted the girl's shoulder, appalled that anyone could be reduced to claiming friendship with a watcher. He winced because the fall had reopened the knife wound in his shoulder, and he hurt. "In truth, a loyal friend," he said, standing patiently until the light in the watcher's green-gold eyes dimmed and died out. All the dragons gave voice to the eerie, hair-raising, barely audible, high, keening note that signified the passing of one of their kind. "He was only a watcher," Lessa murmured, stunned by the tribute, her eyes wide. "The dragons confer honor where they will," Flar remarked dryly, disclaiming the responsibility. And then she looks down at the watcher, removes the collar, and walks away without a backward glance. But there's this whole other level of what happens that's not present in Weir Search.
Yeah, and I think it's a lot better in Dragonflight.
Agreed.
Both in the sense that the death is both sad and meaningful in Dragonflight, where in Weir Search it's just like, oh, that's kind of bleak. Yikes.
Yeah.
But also, Lessa feels kind of brutal in Weir Search in that it kills itself because it's so sad that she won't be there. And then she's just like, man, that sucks.
Well, no, not even that it's sad. It's just like, now I have no purpose in life. Goodbye.
Ah, and then she just kind of walks away. I mean, she still takes the collar off, but I feel like doing that after the dragons have paid tribute to the watchwear feels more. The removal of the collar is her agreeing with them and aligning the watchwear with dragons in nobility, or like it served a noble purpose.
Yeah.
Where here, it doesn't quite hit that note for me.
Yeah.
This also really seems like an early indicator of McCaffrey's preoccupation, which we've discussed, with suicide or suicidal intentions as the only real marker of grief.
Yeah.
That is permitted within the narrative, which is interesting to see, like, right out the gate.
Yeah. Either you have a purpose and meaningful connections with people, or you don't, and you kill yourself. Yikes.
Yeah.
Another question that I had, in sort of the vein of, did she know that Falar and Lessa were going to get together in this story, is, did she know that the time travel plot was going to happen, do we think?
I don't think so.
I also don't think so. There are some things that I'm like, maybe we do get the specific reference to, no one knew why the other five weirs were empty.
And we do get the scene where Lessa feels the premonition of doom, which in Dragonflight is retroactively explained as being caused by time travel.
Yeah, but it's not white enough to make me confident that she knew that that was where it was going.
Yeah, I would believe she just left the empty weirs as a fun dangling thread for herself. Just adds atmospheric vibes.
Yeah, and now I'm kind of mad because I think the books could have been way cooler without the old timers.
You just don't like knife fights.
I think if there are only 140 and then 176 or whatever dragon riders, that's a much more compelling, we have to figure out how to deal with this impossible emergency situation, than the deus ex machina of, oh, we'll just go back in time and bring 2,500 other dragons forward in time. Don't worry about it.
I do think the time travel in some ways ends up causing her problems that she hadn't realized, both in what do I do with all these old timer characters, and we've talked about the weird villain transition and the way that that doesn't quite work.
Yeah.
But also, anytime you introduce time travel to a story, the question then becomes, well, why aren't you using time travel to solve every single problem?
Yeah.
And I think she gestures towards that with making it genuinely risky and also a very closely held trade secret that explains why at various times people have not known that time travel was an available option to solve their problems. But still.
Yeah, and it doesn't explain anything in the ninth pass afterwards, though, because now everyone knows because there's literally a ballad about it.
Yeah. And so you get this awkward weirdness where we get to Skies of Pern, and they're like, well, we have to save everyone from the tsunami with time travel, but we can't tell anyone that that's what we're doing. And I'm like,
Why not?
yeah.
It's not like people don't already know.
And also, frankly, while that whole sequence is written incredibly well and the tension works, and I'm not judging it from the inside, when I step back, I'm like, why are we in a hurry? Just time travel more better.
Yeah.
You could time travel a whole day early and evacuate people with incredible ease.
Yeah.
And again, they do, I think, a solid job of explaining why that won't work. People won't believe you, or it's painful to be in too many times at once, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, it's still a little bit like, okay.
Yeah. That's kind of all we have about Weird Search.
Yeah, and now we come to Dragons Made Me Do It. I can safely say that this was not what I anticipated would happen when we first discussed this in 2013.
Yeah, same. In many ways, I wasn't even thinking about any of the short fiction at that point. I was really just thinking about the novels, and I
Yeah.
wasn't thinking about how many novels there are.
You're just trying to walk it back. You just don't want to admit responsibility.
Yeah,
But
exactly.
this is all Thay's fault, and you should let him know that. Rereading them all has been really interesting.
Yeah.
We didn't quite do it in a year, but pretty close.
Yeah, and I had read slash reread most of the series in 2013, but I skipped some of the ones that I didn't really like. I don't remember if I reread Dragon's Dawn at that point because I was just like, eh, I'm not really that interested. I didn't read Dragon's Eye. I hadn't read Dragon's Eye until 2019, I think. It's really striking and really, in some ways, frustrating and in some ways, cool to see both how much and how little the series changes over the course of 35 years. Which is a long time to be working on one thing.
Yeah, I feel like reading it all gives me a better sense of what she was good at and what she wasn't.
Yeah.
Because some of the things that I would have said, oh, McCaffrey's good at this broadly, I'm now going to say, she was good at this in this specific situation.
Yeah.
She did it really well once or twice, and that's what stuck with me from when I was 12. And so I walked away being like, well, she writes really incredible female characters. Now, I don't know that I can say that, actually.
Yeah, I do think that one of the things that I thought already that she was good at, she is actually really good at, and that is giving you a sense of the world as a thing with social variation, where class matters, where the economics of production matter, and that has changed over time and could change again. She is consistently good at that. The world that she portrays is not necessarily consistent or
No.
coherent across books, but within each book, it is consistent. That, I think, is probably her biggest strength for me as a writer.
Yeah. Some of the books pull me in, some of the books just don't. And I really don't know how much of that is the nostalgia factor and how much of that is genuine variation in quality.
Yeah.
I think nostalgia completely aside, Dragon Drums is just a bad book.
Dragon Drums is not a good book. Yeah.
I don't know if Dragon's Dawn is a good book. I definitely think I love it better than it merits.
And that's how I feel about Dolphins of Pern.
Right. But I think having looked at the entire series, it gives me a better sense for the highs and the lows and the in-betweens.
What would you say your top five Pern books are?
Oh, I gotta be a Dragonflight girl. I will be Alessa Gurley forever, and there's nothing to be done about that. Same with Dragon's Dawn. I gotta be true to who I am. Are they good? No. Do I love them? Yes. I do think Moretta is actually good. And, ooh. After those three, I guess Dragon Song, which I also think is actually good. But even though I read it as a kid and liked it as a kid, I did not have that same emotional attachment to Meneli that I did to Lessa and Sorka. And then rounding it out as number five, probably Chronicles of Pern First Fall, mostly on the strength of the second Weir.
Not Dragon Singer.
No, like I like Dragonsinger,
Okay.
but again, I'm not emotional about it.
Ours are going to be completely different. My top, I would say, is Dragon Singer. And then, what do I think is second? I'm trying to be a little objective about it, sort of.
Why?
Never mind, I'm not being objective about it. I would say Dragon Singer at the top for sure. After that, not necessarily in order, Dragon Song, Dolphins, Dragon Quest. and then Moretta.
Okay.
I'm going back and forth between Dragon Quest and Dragonflight, actually, because I do think Dragonflight is, A, I think it's of historical interest. It's worth reading for that reason. I do also think it's an engaging book. If you click with the characters or the world building at all, it's an engaging book.
Yes.
If you don't, I think it's probably kind of insufferable.
Torturous. Yeah.
But I do, so it's engaging for me. I do think Dragon Quest is maybe more successful overall, in spite of its bizarre pacing.
Yeah.
And it has what for me is one of the best scenes in the series, the mating flight scene. Although I would put the Skies of Pern rescue scene over any of those except Dragon Singer,
Yeah.
but I just wouldn't put the Skies of Pern as a whole above any of those for me.
Yeah. So we agree on Moretta.
We do agree on Moretta.
And that's about it.
Yeah.
I think if we agreed on everything, it would not be an interesting podcast.
Yeah. Although I think we probably could disagree on more things.
Yeah. We just have to be deranged in the same way in order to do the podcast.
Yeah. I'm gonna miss it. Like, I already am a little bit like, oh, I don't have any more Pern to read. I've read all of it now. Whereas until a month ago or whatever, when I read Beyond Between, I had not read all of Pern.
Yep.
And even before that, I'd never read any of the stories in A Gift of Dragons.
Why would you?
That's true. I mean, I don't hate The Smallest Dragon Boy. It's fine, but that's the only one I feel anything more than, I guess that exists about. And what I feel about it is, it's fine.
Right, so we've had our top five. What are your bottom three?
Ooh.
Two's too easy.
Okay, so it's gotta be Dragon Drums, first of all.
Yes.
It's just so bad. And then I think it's probably gotta be Renegades. And for me, honestly, All the Weirs of Pern, I just don't like it. No, that's a lie. Sorry, I forgot. All the Weirs of Pern is not as bad as Norilka.
Okay, I think for me, my bottom two is Dragon Drums and Renegades, and then Gift of Dragons,
Okay.
because I don't like insipidity.
Fair
It
enough.
bothers me. All the Weirs of Pern, there's some stuff that's good.
Okay, what about novels specifically, though?
Novels specifically, honestly, The White Dragon is down there for me.
I mean, yeah, fair enough.
Norilka is frustrating because I think Norilka, the character, was really cool in Moretta, and I want her to have a better story.
Yeah.
Where The White Dragon, I'm just like, I don't want to be here.
I don't know. Jackson makes me insane, and Norilka does not make me insane.
Yes.
She could, if the book were ever so slightly more self-aware about the possibility of lesbians or bisexuality, but it's not. And as a result, I'm just like, Norilka, you could have been good, but you aren't. Whereas Jackson, I'm like, oh, you are so close to being good, and you're still not, but you're, oh, it's just like a couple more inches and you could be there.
Yep. What was the most surprising thing?
Good question. How good Skies of Pern was.
Yeah.
That was by far the thing I was most surprised by of anything that came up as we were reading.
For me, one of the biggest surprises was how much the series as a whole does slant towards male protagonists.
Yeah, that's true
Because I
also.
absolutely had not picked up on that. And some of that was about which books I didn't read as a kid.
Yeah, same. A lot of Dragon Song and Dragon Singer,
Yeah.
and then I had the abridged Master Harper of Pern, but it was abridged in a way that included a bunch of the Marilyn stuff, so she felt like she was still a main character.
Yeah.
And then Dolphins. But the balance in terms of what I listened to most was very much Dragon Song and Dragon Singer, with Dolphins as a slightly trailing third.
Yeah. A lot of the racism went over my head and the ableism went over my head when I read it as a kid, but I was not at all surprised to come back to it and find it there, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately, a lot of the stuff that I read as a kid and enjoyed is very racist. And only as an adult am I looking at it and going like, oh, that sucks.
Yeah.
But I was expecting it to be a lot more feminist than it actually was, I think.
Yeah, I definitely was already ambivalent about identifying the series as feminist science fiction just because of how much of a mess Dragonflight is about gender and sexuality.
Yeah, when I say I was expecting it to be more feminist, I'm not saying I expected it to be feminist. It's just that I thought it was sort of in the middle in an interesting way, and it's barely even there sometimes.
Rereading all of it, everything from start to finish, has really driven home how unhinged a lot of Pern scholarship is, because so many people seem to approach the series from the perspective of, like, well, McCaffrey was a woman writing sci-fi relatively early in terms of the professional scene after the transition from short fiction to novels. So obviously it must be feminist science fiction. I'm like, well, If you read the book, it's not, though. If you read the books, it's really not.
Did you read the books? You didn't. Okay.
I had already thought that about specific things, but it really becomes even more apparent as the series goes on, even after the dramatic beginning. And some of it is just there's not a lot of recent Pern scholarship, so it's not that surprising, I guess, that people haven't really dealt with the later books. But I really feel like even in the earlier books, if you were working in the mid-90s, you probably should have looked back and been like, huh, that's kind of fucked up. And not like, yeah, this is a model for a good romantic relationship. Really? Falar and Lessa? That's. Are
I
you
don't know about
sure
that.
that's what you want to say?
Yeah. Thank you very much, gentle listeners, for listening.
Yes, thank you so much.
We were very much expecting for this to just be something we did for fun. And the fact that there are even three or four people who are not our friends who are listening to this is wild to us.
Yeah, I hope that you all have enjoyed it as much as we have, because we have, as you've probably been able to tell, had a blast with this, even when it's involved reading Beyond Between.
Well, I
Okay,
guess.
even when it's involved reading The White Dragon,
Yes.
the resulting conversation was fun enough to make up for.
Having to read the book, yes.
Yes.
And we're not completely done because we are currently intending to do a season two, if you will, which will be at a slower pace, probably because this is not quite sustainable for us. And we'll be focusing on other content that we think is in dialogue with Pern books in an interesting way, and some more bonus episode style thinking and discussing the world building and the context in which it was written without obviously linking that to a specific book because we've run out of those.
Yes.
We will not be reading Todd books.
We will not be reading Todd books. You will get to hear, probably at some length, at some point, about the fake good versions of Pern that live in our respective heads. So that'll be something to look forward to.
So brace yourself.
And.
One single person was like, yeah, read The Fourth Wing, and we caved.
Well, no, multiple people have been like, oh, have you read Fourth Wing?
Yes.
And both of us were like, oh, fine, we're curious enough. We are also maybe gonna release a blooper reel episode for season one if we can figure out a good way to do it. It's a little harder to imagine what that entails with audio, but we're pondering.
And we've definitely bloopered enough.
We sure have. You may also be able to look forward to some Zoom transcript outtakes. Zoom has been extremely useful and also extremely creative with its interpretations of character names, sometimes in very funny ways.
And in the end, having done all of this and read all of those, I do not recommend that you read Pern.
I'm gonna be honest, I do recommend that you read Pern. I'm sorry, I'm tired of pretending
Crimes! Crimes!
that I don't. I do think people should read Pern. I think it's of historical interest. I think some of the books are genuinely good. I can't keep lying about this.
There are other better things to read. There are other better things to spend your time reading.
It's true that there are other better things. I think people should read a couple Pern books. I don't think people should read the whole
You
series.
only live so long, Faye. You only live so
Yes, I
long.
do, however, have a recommendation. I was thinking about Weird Search specifically and the way that it's balancing science fiction with fantasy elements. And I would recommend Elizabeth A. Lynn's short story, The Gods of Rayorth, which is a science fictional premise, but also with fantasy trappings about a woman who is stationed on a distant planet acting as a kind of god slash oracle, but aided by her technology.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Dragons Made Me Do It. If you enjoyed it and want to hear more, you can follow us on Tumblr at dmmdipodcast.tumblr.com for updates or to send us questions or comments, and you can find our archive of episodes, along with transcripts, recommendations, funny memes, and more at dmmdipodcast.neocities.org, NEO Cities.